That relationship would now change. It had to. America was now committing its own troops to Israeli defense. That made America partly responsible for the defense of Israel, and reciprocally made Israel responsible for the safety of the Americans, something the American media had not yet noted. That was the Mossad's department. Intelligence sharing would have to become a much wider street than it had been. Avi didn't like that. Despite the euphoria of the moment, America was not a country with which to entrust secrets, particularly those obtained after much effort and often blood by intelligence officers in his employ. Soon the Americans would be sending a senior intelligence representative to work out the details. They'd send Ryan, of course. Avi started making notes. He needed to get as much information as he could on Ryan so that he could cut as favorable a deal with the Americans as possible. Ryan. Was it true that he'd gotten this whole thing started? There was a question, Ben Jakob thought. The American government had denied it, but Ryan was not a favorite of President Fowler or his national security bitch, Elizabeth Elliot. The information on her was quite clear. While professor of political science at Bennington, she'd had PLO representatives in to lecture on their view of the Middle East, in the name of fairness and balance. It could have been worse. She wasn't Vanessa Redgrave, dancing with an AK-47 held over her head, Avi told himself, but her objectivity had stretched to the point of listening politely to the representatives of the people who'd attacked Israeli children at Maalot and Israeli athletes at Munich. Like most members of the American government, she had forgotten what principle was. But Ryan wasn't one of those. The treaty was his work. His sources were right. Fowler and Elliot would never have come up with an idea like this. Using religion as the key would never have occurred to them. The treaty. He went back to it, returning to his notes. How had the government ever allowed itself to be maneuvered into this? We shall overcome. That simple, wasn't it? The panicked telephone calls and cables from Israel's American friends, the way they were starting to jump ship, as though... But how could it have been otherwise? Avi asked himself. In any case, the Vatican Treaty was a done deal. Probably a done deal, he told himself. The eruptions in the Israeli population had begun, and the next few days would be passionate. The reasons were simple enough to understand. Israel was essentially vacating the West Bank. Army units would remain in place, much as American units were still based in Germany and Japan, but the West Bank was to become a Palestinian state, demilitarized, its borders guaranteed by the UN, which was probably a nice sheet of framed parchment, Ben Jakob reflected. The real guarantee would come from Israel and America. Saudi Arabia and its sister Gulf states would pay for the economic rehabilitation of the Palestinians. Access to Jerusalem was guaranteed also. That's where most of the Israeli troops would be, with large and easily secured base camps and the right to patrol at will. Jerusalem itself became a dominion of the Vatican. An elected mayor. He wondered if the Israeli now holding the post would keep his post. Why not? He asked himself. He was the most even-handed of men. Would handle civil administration, but international and religious affairs would be managed under Vatican authority by a troika of three clerics. Local security for Jerusalem was to be handled by a Swiss motorized regiment. Avi might have snorted at that, but the Swiss had been the model for the Israeli army, and the Swiss were supposed to train with the American regiment. The 10th Cavalry were supposed to be crack regular troops. On paper, it was all very neat. Things on paper usually were. On Israel's streets, however, the rabid demonstrations had already begun. Thousands of Israeli citizens were to be displaced. Two police officers and a soldier had already been hurt, at Israeli hands. The Arabs were keeping out of everyone's way. A separate commission run by the Saudis would try to settle which Arab family owned what piece of ground, a situation that Israel had thoroughly muddled when it had seized land that might or might not have been owned by Arabs and, but that was not Avi's problem, and he thanked God for it. His given name was Abraham, not Solomon. Will it work? He wondered. It cannot possibly work, Kati told himself. Word that a treaty had been signed had thrown him into a 10-hour bout of nausea, and now that he had the treaty text, he felt himself at death's door itself. Peace? And yet Israel will continue to exist? What then of his sacrifices? What of the hundreds, thousands of freedom fighters sacrificed under Israeli guns and bombs? For what had they died? For what had Kati sacrificed his life? He might as well have died, Kati told himself. He'd denied himself everything. He might have lived a normal life, might have had a wife and sons and a house and comfortable work, might have been a doctor or engineer or banker or merchant. He had the intelligence to succeed at anything his mind selected as worthy of himself, but no, he had chosen the most difficult of paths. His goal was to build a new nation, to make a home for his people, to give them the human dignity they deserved, to lead his people, to defeat the invaders, to be remembered. That was what he craved. Anyone could recognize injustice, but to remedy it would have allowed him to be remembered as a man who had changed the course of human history, if only in a small way, if only for a small nation. That wasn't true, Kati admitted to himself. To accomplish his task meant defying the great nations, the Americans and Europeans who had inflicted their prejudices on his ancient homeland, and men who did that were not remembered as small men. Were he successful, he would be remembered among the great, for great deeds define great men, and the great men were those whom history remembered. But whose deeds would be remembered now? Who had conquered what? Or whom? It was not possible, the commander told himself. Yet his stomach told him something else as he read over the treaty text with its dry, precise words. The Palestinian people, his noble, courageous people, could they possibly be seduced by this infamy? Kati stood and walked back to his private bathroom to retch again. That, part of his brain said, even as he bent over the bowl, was the answer to his question. After a time, he stood and drank a glass of water to remove the vile taste from his mouth. But there was another taste that was not so easily removed. Across the street, in another safe house run by the organization, Gunter Bach was listening to Deutsche Welle's German overseas radio service. Despite his politics and his location, Bach would never stop thinking of himself as a German. A German revolutionary socialist, to be sure, but a German. It had been another warm day in his true home, the radio reported, with clear skies, a fine day to walk along the Rhine holding Petra's hand. And the brief news report stopped his heart. Convicted murderess Petra Hassler-Bock was found hanged in her prison cell this afternoon, the victim of an apparent suicide. The wife of escaped terrorist Gunter Bock, Petra Hassler-Bock was convicted of the brutal murder of Wilhelm Manstein after her arrest in Berlin and sentenced to life imprisonment. Petra Hassler-Bock was 38 years of age. The resurgence of the Dresden Football Club has surprised many observers. Led by star forward Willi Scheer, Bach's eyes went wide in the unlit darkness of his room. Unable even to look at the lit radio dial, his eyes found the open window and stared at the stars of evening. Petra? Dead? He knew it was true, knew better than to tell himself it was impossible. It was all too possible. Inevitable, in fact. Apparent suicide. Of course, just as all the Baader-Meinhof members had apparently committed suicide, one having reportedly shot himself in the head, 3 times. A real death grip on the gun had been the joke in the West German police community of the time. They'd murdered his wife, Bach knew. His beautiful Petra was dead. His best friend, his truest comrade, his lover, dead. It should not have hit him as hard as it did, Gunther knew. What else might he have expected? They'd had to kill her, of course. She was both a link with the past and a potentially dangerous link with Germany's socialist future. In killing her, they'd further secured the political stability of the new Germany, Das Wirtareich.
Petra,
he whispered to himself. She was more than a political figure, more than a revolutionary. He remembered every contour of her face, every curve of her youthful body. He remembered waiting for their children to be born, and the smile with which she'd greeted him after delivering Erica and Ursel. They too were gone, as totally removed from him as though they'd also died. It was not a time to be alone. Bach dressed and walked across the street. Kati, he was glad to see, was still awake, though he looked ghastly. "What is wrong, my friend?" the commander asked. "Petra, he's dead." Kati showed genuine pain on his face.
"What happened?"
"The report is that she was found dead in her cell."
"Hanged."
His Petra, Bach thought in delayed shock, found strangled by her graceful neck. The image was too painful for contemplation. He'd seen that kind of death. He and Petra had executed a class enemy that way and watched his face turn pale, then darken, and the image was unbearable. He could not allow himself to see Petra that way. Kati bowed his head in sorrow.
"May Allah have mercy on our beloved comrade."
Bach managed not to frown. Neither he nor Petra had ever believed in God, but Kati had meant well by his prayer, even though it was nothing more than a waste of breath. At the very least, it was an expression of sympathy and goodwill. And friendship. Bach needed that right now, and so he ignored the irrelevancy and took a deep breath.
"It is a bad day for our cause, Ismail." "Worse than you think, this cursed treaty."
"I know," Bach said. "I know."
"What do you think?"
One thing Kati could depend on was Bach's honesty. Gunther was objective about everything. The German took a cigarette from the commander's desk and lit it from the table lighter. He didn't sit, but rather paced the room. He had to move about to prove to himself that he was still alive, as he commanded his mind to consider the question objectively. "Von Must sees this as merely one part of a larger plan. When the Russians betrayed world socialism, they set in motion a series of events aimed at solidifying control over most of the world on the part of the capitalist classes. I used to think that the Soviets merely advanced this as a matter of clever strategy, to get economic assistance for themselves. You must understand that the Russians are a backward people, Ismail. They couldn't even make communism work. Of course, communism was invented by a German," he added with an ironic grimace. That Marx had been a Jew was something he diplomatically left out. Bach paused for a moment, then went on with a coldly analytical voice. He was grateful for the chance to close the door briefly on his emotions and speak like the revolutionary of old. "I was wrong. It was not a question of tactics at all. It is a complete betrayal. Progressive elements within the Soviet Union have been outmaneuvered even more thoroughly than in the DDR. Their rapprochement with America is quite genuine. They are trading ideological purity for temporary prosperity, yes, but there is no plan on their part to return to the socialist fold. America, for its part, is charging a price for the help they offer. America forced the Soviets to deny support for Iraq, to lessen support for you and your Arab brothers, and finally to accede to their plan to secure Israel once and for all. Clearly, the Israel lobby in America has been planning this trick for some time. What makes it different is Soviet acquiescence. What we now face is not merely America, but conspiracy on a global scale. We have no friends, Ismail. We have only ourselves.
Do you say we are defeated?
No. Bach's eyes blazed for a moment. If we stop now, they have advantage enough already, my friend. Give them one more and they will use the current state of affairs to hunt all of us down. Your relationship with the Russians is as bad as it has ever been. It will get worse still. Next, the Russians will begin cooperation with the Americans and Zionists.
Who would have ever thought that the Americans and Russians would...
No one. No one except those who brought it about. The American ruling elite and their bot dogs, Narmanov and his lackeys. They were exceedingly clever, my friend. We ought to have seen it coming, but we did not. You didn't see it coming here. I never saw it coming in Europe. The failure was ours. Carty told himself that the truth was precisely what he needed to hear, but his stomach told him something else entirely.
What ideas do you have for remedying the situation? The commander asked.
We are faced with an alliance of two very unlikely friends, and their hangers-on. One must find a way to destroy the alliance. In historical terms, when an alliance is broken, the former allies are even more suspicious of each other than they were before the alliance was formed. How to do that? Bach shrugged. I don't know. That will require time. The opportunities are there. Should be there, he corrected himself. There is much potential for discord. There are many people who feel as we do. Many still in Germany who feel as I do.
But you say it must begin between America and Russia, Carty asked, interested as always by his friend's meanderings.
That is where it must lead. If there were a way to make it start there, so much the better. But that would seem unlikely.
Perhaps not as unlikely as you imagine, Gunther, Carty said to himself, scarcely aware that he'd spoken aloud.
Excuse me?
Nothing. We will discuss this later. I am tired, my friend.
Forgive me for troubling you, Ismail. We will avenge Petra, my friend. They will pay for their crimes, Carty promised him.
Thank you.
Bach left. 2 minutes later, he was back in his room. The radio was still on, now playing traditional music. It came back to him then, the weight of the moment. He did not manage tears, however. All Bach felt was rage. Petra's death was a wrenching personal tragedy, but his whole world of ideas had been betrayed. The death of his wife was just one more symptom of a deeper and more virulent disease. The whole world would pay for Petra's murder if he could manage it. All in the name of revolutionary justice, of course. Sleep came hard for Kati. Surprisingly, part of the problem was guilt. He, too, had his memories of Petra Hassler and her supple body. She hadn't been married to Gunther then, and the thought of her dead, found at the end of a German rope.
How had she died?
Suicide, the news report had said.
Carty believed it.
They were brittle, these Europeans. Clever, but brittle. They knew the passion of the struggle, but they did not know of endurance. Their advantage lay in their broader view. That came from their more cosmopolitan environment and their generally superior education. Whereas Kati and his people tended to be overly focused on their immediate problem, their European comrades could see the broader issues more clearly. The moment of perceptive clarity came as something of a surprise. Kati and his people had always regarded the Europeans as comrades, but not as equals, as dilettantes in the business of revolution. That was a mistake. They had always faced a more rigorous revolutionary task, because they lacked the ready-made sea of discontent from which Cotty and his colleagues drew their recruits. That they had been less successful in their goals was due to objective circumstances, not a reflection on their intelligence or dedication. Bach could have made a superb operations officer, because he saw things clearly. And now? Cotty asked himself. That was a question, but one that would require time for contemplation. It was not a question for a hasty answer. He'd sleep on that one for several days. More like a week, the commander promised himself, as he tried to find sleep. I have the great privilege and high honor of introducing the President of the United States. The assembled members of Congress stood as one person from their crowded seats in the House chamber. Arrayed in the front row were the members of the cabinet, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the justices of the Supreme Court, who also rose. In the balconies were others, among them the Saudi and Israeli ambassadors, sitting side by side for the first time in memory. The TV cameras panned the great room in which both history and infamy had been made. The applause echoed from wall to wall until hands grew red from it. President Fowler rested his notes on the lectern. He turned to shake the hand of the Speaker of the House, the President pro tempore of the Senate, and his own Vice President, Roger Durling. In the euphoria of the moment, no one would comment that Durling came last. Next, he turned to smile and wave at the assembled multitude, and the noise increased yet again. Every gesture in Fowler's repertoire came into play. The one-hand wave, the two-hand wave, hands at shoulder level, and hands over the head. The response was truly bipartisan, and that was remarkable, Fowler noted. His most vociferous enemies in the House and Senate were assiduous in their enthusiasm, and he knew it to be genuine. There still was true patriotism in the Congress, much to the surprise of everyone. Finally, he waved for silence, and the applause grudgingly subsided. My fellow Americans, I come to this House to report on recent events in Europe and the Middle East, and to lay before the United States Senate a pair of treaty documents which, I hope, will meet with your speedy and enthusiastic approval. More applause. With these treaties, the United States, operating in close cooperation with many other nations, some trusted old friends and some valuable new ones, has helped to bring about peace in a region that has helped to give peace to the world, but which has known all too little peace itself. One can search all of human history. One can trace the evolution of the human spirit. All of human progress, all the shining lights that have lit our way up from barbarism, all the great and good men and women who have prayed and dreamed and hoped and worked for this moment. This moment, this opportunity, this culmination is the last page in the history of human conflict. We have reached not a starting point, but a stopping point. More applause interrupted the president. He was very slightly annoyed, having not planned for this interruption. Fowler smiled broadly, waving for silence. We have reached a stopping point. I have the honor to report to you that America has led the way on the road to justice and peace. Applause. It is fitting that this should be so. A little thick, isn't it? Kathy Ryan asked. A little. Jack grunted in his chair and reached for his wine. It's just how things go, babe. There are rules for this sort of thing, just as there are for opera. You have to follow the formula. Besides, it is a major, hell, a colossal development. Peace is breaking out again. When are you leaving? Kathy asked. Soon, Jack replied. Of course, there is a price we must pay for this, but history demands responsibility from those who forge it, Fowler said on the TV. It is our task to guarantee the peace. We must send American men and women to protect the state of Israel. We are sworn to defend that small and courageous country against all enemies. What enemies are they? Kathy asked. Syria isn't happy with the treaty as yet. Neither is Iran. As far as Lebanon goes, well, there isn't any Lebanon in any real sense of the word. It's just a place on the map where people die. Libya and all those terrorist groups. There are still enemies to be concerned about. Ryan finished off the glass and walked into the kitchen to refill it. It was a shame to waste good wine like this, Jack told himself. The way he was guzzling it, he might as well drink anything. There will be a monetary cost as well, Fowler was saying as Ryan came back. Taxes are going up again, Kathy observed crossly. Well, what did you expect? 50 million of it is my fault, of course. 1 billion here and 1 billion there. Will this really make a difference? She asked. It should. We'll find out if all those religious leaders believe in what they say or if they're just bullshit artists. What we've done is to hoist them on their own petards, babe. Make that principles, Jack said after a moment. Either they work things out in accordance with their beliefs or they reveal themselves as charlatans. And? I don't think they're charlatans. I think they'll be faithful to what they've always said. They have to be. And soon, you won't have any real work to do, will you? Jack caught the hopeful note in her voice. I don't know about that. After the end of the president's speech came the commentary. Speaking in opposition was Rabbi Solomon Mendeleev, an elderly New Yorker who was one of Israel's most fervent, some would say rabid, supporters. Oddly, he'd never actually traveled to Israel. Jack didn't know why that was true and made a mental note to find out why tomorrow. Mendeleev led a small but effective segment of the Israeli lobby. He'd been nearly alone in voicing approval, well, understanding, of the shootings on Temple Mount. The rabbi had a beard and wore a black yarmulke over what looked like a well-rumpled suit. This is a betrayal of the State of Israel, he said after receiving the first question. Surprisingly, he spoke with calm reason. In forcing Israel to return what was rightfully hers, the United States has betrayed the Jewish people's historic right to the land of their fathers, and also gravely compromised the physical security of the country. Israeli citizens will be forced from their homes at gunpoint, just as happened 50 years ago, he concluded ominously. Now wait a minute, another commentator responded heatedly. God, these people are passionate, Jack noted. I lost family members in the Holocaust, Mendeleev said, his voice still reasonable. The whole point of the State of Israel is to give Jews a place where they can be safe. But the president is sending American troops. We sent American troops to Vietnam, Rabbi Mendeleev pointed out. And we made promises, and there was a treaty involved there also. Israel's only possible security is within defensible borders behind her own troops. What America has done is to bully that country into accepting an agreement. Fowler cut off defense supplies to Israel as a means of sending a message. Well, the message was sent and received. Either give in or be cut off. That is what happened. I can prove it, and I will testify before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to prove it. Oh, Jack observed quietly. Scott Adler, Deputy Secretary of State, personally delivered that message while John Ryan, the Deputy Director of the CIA, made his own pitch to Saudi Arabia. Ryan promised the Saudi king that America would bring Israel to heel. That's bad enough, but for Adler, a Jew, to do what he did. Mendeleev shook his head. This guy's got some good sources. Is what he says true, Jack? Kathy asked. Not exactly. But what we were doing over there was supposed to be secret. It wasn't supposed to be widely known that I was out of the country. I knew you were gone, but not where to. It won't matter. He can make a little noise, but it won't matter. The demonstrations began the next day. They'd bet everything on this. It was the last desperate throw. The two leaders were Russian Jews who'd only recently been allowed to leave a country that manifestly had little love for them. On arrival in their only true home, they'd been allowed to settle on the West Bank, that part of Palestine that had been taken from Jordan by force of arms in the Six-Day War of 1967. Their prefabricated apartments, tiny by American standards but incomprehensibly luxurious by Russian ones, stood on one of the hundreds of rocky slopes that defined the region. It was new and strange to them, but it was home, and home is something people fight to defend. The son of Anatoly, he'd renamed himself Nathan, was already a regular officer in the Israeli army. The same was true of David's daughter. Their arrival into Israel so short a time before had seemed to all of them like salvation itself, and now they were being told to leave their homes? Again? Their lives had borne enough recent shocks. This was one too many. The whole block of apartments was similarly occupied by Russian immigrants, and it was easy for Anatoly and David to form a local collective and get things properly organized. They found themselves an Orthodox rabbi, the only thing they didn't have in their small community, to provide religious guidance, and began their march toward the Knesset behind a sea of flags and a holy Torah. Even in so small a country, this took time, but the march was of such a nature as to attract the inevitable media coverage. By the time the sweating and weary marchers arrived at their destination, all the world knew of their trek and its purpose. The Israeli Knesset is not the most sedate of the world's parliamentary bodies. The body of men and women ranges from the ultra-right to the ultra-left, with precious little room for a moderate middle. Voices are often raised, fists are often shaken or pounded on whatever surface presents itself, all beneath the black and white photo of Theodor Herzl, an Austrian whose ideal of Zionism in the mid-19th century was the guiding vision for what he hoped would be a safe homeland for his abused and mistreated people. The passion of the parliamentarians is such as to make many an observer wonder how it is possible, in a country where nearly everyone is a member of the Army Reserves and consequently has an automatic weapon in his or her closet, that some Knesset members have failed to be blasted to quivering fragments at their seats in the course of a spirited debate. But Theodor Herzl would have thought of the goings-on is anyone's guess. It was Israel's curse that the debates were too lively, the government too severely polarized both on political and religious grounds. Almost every religious subsect had its own special area of land, and consequently its own parliamentary representation. It was a formula calculated to make France's often fragmented assembly look well organized, and it had for a generation denied Israel a stable government with a coherent national policy. The demonstrators, joined by many others, arrived an hour before debate was to begin on the question of the treaties. It was already possible, likely, that the government would fall, and the newly arrived citizens sent representatives to every member of the Knesset they could locate. Members who agreed with them came outside and gave fiery speeches denouncing the treaties. "I don't like this," Liz Elliott observed, watching the TV in her office. The political furor in Israel was much stronger than she had expected, and Elliot had called Ryan in for an assessment of the situation. "Well," the DDCI agreed, "it is the one thing we couldn't control, isn't it?"
"You're a big help, Ryan."
On Elliot's desk was the polling data. Israel's most respected public opinion firm had conducted a survey of 5,000 people and found the numbers were 38% in favor of the treaty, 41% opposed, and 21% undecided. The numbers roughly matched the political makeup of the Knesset, whose right-wing members slightly outnumbered the left, and whose precarious center was always fragmented into small groupings, all of which waited for a good offer from one side or the other that would magnify their political importance. Scott Adler went over this weeks ago. "We knew going in that the Israeli government was shaky. For Christ's sake, when in the last 20 years has it not been shaky?"
"But if the prime minister cannot deliver..."
Then it's back to Plan B. You wanted to put pressure on their government, didn't you? You'll get your wish. This was the one thing that hadn't been fully considered, Ryan thought, but the truth of the matter was that full consideration would not have helped. The Israeli government had been a model of anarchy in action for a generation. The treaty work had gone ahead on the assumption that once transformed into a fait accompli, the treaty would have to be ratified by the Knesset. Ryan had not been asked for an opinion on that, though he still thought it a fair assessment. The political officer at the embassy says that the balance of power may be the little party controlled by our friend Mendeleev, Elliot noted, trying to be calm. Maybe so, Jack allowed. It's absurd, Elliot snarled. That little old fart hasn't even been there. Some sort of religious thing, I checked. He doesn't want to go back until the Messiah arrives. Jesus, the National Security Advisor exclaimed. Exactly. You got it. Ryan laughed and got a nasty look. Look, Liz, the man has his personal religious beliefs. We may think they're a little off, but the Constitution demands that we both tolerate and respect them. That's the way we do things in this country, remember? Elliot waved her fist at the TV set. But this crazy rabbi is screwing things up. Isn't there anything we can do about it? Like what? Jack asked quietly. There was more to her demeanor than panic. I don't know. Something? Elliot allowed her voice to trail off, leaving an opening for her visitor. Ryan leaned forward and waited until he had her full attention. The historical precedent you're looking for, Dr. Elliot, is, will no one rid me of this troublesome priest? Now, if you're trying to tell me something, let's get it clear and in the open, shall we? Are you proposing that we interfere with the parliament of a friendly, democratic country, or that we do something illegal within the borders of the United States of America? A pause while her eyes focused a little more tightly. Neither one of those things will happen, Dr. Elliot. We let them make up their own mind. If you even think of telling me to interfere with Israel's democratic processes, the president gets my resignation just as fast as I can drive down here to deliver it. If you're wishing out loud for us to hurt that little old guy in New York, remember that such wishes fall under at least two conspiracy statutes. My duty as an ordinary citizen, much less an official of the government of my country, is to report suspected violations of the law to the appropriate law enforcement agencies. The look Ryan got after his pronouncement was venomous. Damn you. I never said. You just fell into the most dangerous trap in government service, ma'am. You started to think that your wishes to make the world a better place supersede the principles under which our government is supposed to operate. I can't stop you from having such thoughts, but I can tell you that my agency will not be a party to it, not as long as I'm there. It sounded too much like a lecture, but Ryan felt that she needed it. She was entertaining the most dangerous of thoughts. I never said that! Bullshit. Fine. You never said or thought that. I was mistaken. You have my apology. Let the Israelis decide to ratify the treaties or not. They have a democratic government. It is their right to decide. We have the right to nudge them in the right direction, to tell them that our continued level of aid is contingent upon their agreeing to it, but not to interfere directly with their governmental processes. There are some lines you may not cross, even if you happen to be the U.S. government. The National Security Advisor managed a smile. Thank you for your views on the matter of proper government policy, Dr. Ryan. That will be all. Thank you, Dr. Elliot. My assessment, by the way, is that we should let things be. The treaty will be approved despite what you see here. Why? Elliot managed not to hiss. The treaties are good for Israel in any objective sense. The people will realize that as soon as they've had a chance to digest the information and make their views known to their representatives. Israel is a democracy. And democracies generally do the smart thing. History, you see. Democracy has become popular in the world because it works. If we panic and take precipitous action, we'll only mess things up. If we let the process work as it's supposed to work, the right thing will probably happen. Probably? There are no certainties in life. There are only probabilities, Ryan explained. Why didn't everyone understand that? He wondered to himself. But interference has a higher probability of failure than doing nothing. Doing nothing at all is often the right thing. This is such a case. Let their system work. I think it will work. That is my opinion. Thank you for your assessment, she said, turning away. A pleasure as always. Elliot waited until she heard the door close before turning to look. You arrogant prick. I'll break you for that, she promised. Ryan climbed back into his car on West Executive Drive. You went too far, man, he told himself. No, you didn't. She was starting to think that way, and you had to slam the door on it right there and then. It was the most dangerous thought that a person in government could have. He'd seen it before. Some dreadful thing happened to people in Washington, D.C. They arrived in the city, usually full of ideals, and those fine thoughts evaporated so rapidly in what was, in fact, a muggy and humid environment. Some called it being captured by the system. Ryan thought of it as a kind of environmental pollution. The very atmosphere of Washington corroded the soul. And what makes you immune, Jack? Ryan considered that, unmindful of the look Clark gave him in the mirror as they drove toward the river. What had made him different to this point was the fact that he had never given in, not even once. Or had he? There were things he might have done differently. There were some things that hadn't worked out quite as well as he might have wished. You're not different at all. You just think you are. As long as I can face the question and the answers, then I am safe. Sure. So? So I can do many things, Gon replied. But not alone. I will need help. And security? That is an important question. I have to make a serious assessment of what the possibilities are. At that point, I will know my precise requirements. I know I will need help in some areas, however. Such as, the commander asked. The explosives. But you are an expert in such things, Kati objected. Commander, this task requires precision such as we have never been forced to face. We cannot use ordinary plastic explosives, for example, for the simple reason that they are plastic. They change shape. The explosive blocks I use must be as rigid as stone, must be shaped to a thousandth of a millimeter, and the shape must be determined mathematically. The theoretical side of that is something I could assimilate, but it will take months. I would rather devote my time to refabricating the nuclear material, and... Yes? I believe I can improve the bomb, Commander. Improve? How? If my initial readings are correct, this type of weapon can be adapted to become not a bomb, but a trigger. Trigger for what? Kati asked. A thermonuclear fusion bomb. A hydrogen bomb, Ismail. The yield of the weapon might be increased by a factor of 10, perhaps 100. We could destroy Israel. Certainly a very large part of it. The commander paused for a few breaths, assimilating that bit of information. When he spoke softly. But you need help. Where might be the best place?
Gunther may have some valuable contacts in Germany. If he can be trusted, Gon added.
I have considered this. Gunther can be trusted. Kati explained why.
We are sure the story is real, Gon asked.
I have no more faith in coincidences than you, Commander.
There was a photograph in a German newspaper. It appeared quite genuine. A German tabloid had managed to get a graphic black-and-white photo that showed the results of a hanging in all its ghastly splendor. The fact that Petra was nude above the waist had ensured its publication. Such an end for a terrorist murderer was too juicy to be denied to the German males, one of whom had been castrated by this woman. The problem is simply that we must minimize the number of people who know about this, else... Excuse me, Ismail. But we need some help. Yes, I understand that. Kati smiled. You are correct. It is time to discuss our plans with our friend. You propose to explode the bomb in Israel. Where else? It is not my place to make such plans, but I assumed. I have not thought about it. One thing at a time, Ibrahim. When are you leaving for Israel? I plan to do so in the next week or so. Let it wait until we see what this treaty business will do. Kati thought. Begin your studies. We will make haste slowly on this matter. First, you must determine your requirements. We will then try to meet them in the most secure location we can arrange. It took forever, it seemed, but forever in political terms can be a time period ranging from 5 minutes to 5 years. In this case, it took less than 3 days for the important part to happen. 50,000 more demonstrators arrived before the Knesset. Led by veterans of all of Israel's wars, the new crowd supported the treaties. There were more shouts and shaken fists, but for once there was no overt violence as the police managed to keep the two passionate groups separated. Instead, they labored to outshout each other. The cabinet met again in closed session, both ignoring and attending to the din outside their windows. The defense minister was surprisingly quiet during the discussion. On being asked, he agreed that the additional arms promised by the Americans would be hugely useful. 48 additional F-16 fighter bombers, and for the first time, M-23 Bradley fighting vehicles, Hellfire anti-tank missiles, and access to the revolutionary new tank gun technology America was developing. The Americans would underwrite most of the cost of building a high-tech training center in the Negev, similar to their own national training center at Fort Irwin, California, where the 10th Cav unit would train constantly as the OP4, or opposing force, against Israeli units. The defense minister knew the effect the NTC had had for the U.S. Army, which was at its highest state of professionalism since World War II. With the new materiel and training base, he judged that the real effectiveness of Israel's defense forces would increase by 50%. To that he added the U.S. Air Force F-16 wing and the tank regiment, both of which, as spelled out in a secret codicil of the Mutual Defense Treaty, chopped to Israeli command in time of emergency, a situation that was defined by Israel. That was totally unprecedented in American history, the foreign minister pointed out. So, is our national security degraded or enhanced by the treaties? The prime minister asked. It is somewhat enhanced, the defense minister admitted. Then will you say so? Defense pondered that for a moment, his eyes boring in on the man seated at the head of the table. Will you support me when I make my bid for the premiership? His eyes asked. The prime minister nodded. I will address the crowds. We can live with these treaties. The speech did not pacify everyone, but it was enough to convince a third of the anti-treaty demonstrators to depart. The crucial middle element in the Israeli parliament observed the events, consulted its conscience, and made its decision. The treaties were ratified by a slim margin. Even before the United States Senate had a chance to clear the treaties through the Armed Services and Foreign Relations Committees, implementation of both agreements began. Chapter 11. Robo-Soldiers.
They weren't supposed to look human. The Swiss guards were all over 185 centimeters in height, and not one weighed less than 85 kilograms, which translated to about 6'1 and 180 pounds for American tourists. Their physical fitness was manifest. The guard encampment, just outside the city in what had been a Jewish settlement until less than 2 weeks before, had its own high-tech gymnasium, and the men were encouraged to pump iron until their exposed skin looked as taut as a drumhead. Their forearms, exposed below rolled-up sleeves, were thicker than the lower legs of most men, and already tanned brown beneath what were often sun-bleached blonde hairs. Their mostly blue eyes were always hidden behind dark glasses in the case of the officers, and tinted Lexan shields for the rest. They were outfitted in fatigues of an urban camouflage pattern, a curious design of black, white, and several shades of gray that allowed them to blend in with the stones and whitewashed stucco of Jerusalem in a way that was eerily effective, especially at night. Their boots were the same, not the spit-shined elegance of parade soldiers. The helmets were Kevlar, covered with cloth of the same pattern. Over the fatigues went camouflaged flak jackets of American design that merely seemed to increase the physical bulk of the soldiers. Over the flak jackets came the web gear. Each man always carried 4 fragmentation grenades and 2 smokes, plus a 1-liter canteen, first aid packet, and ammo pouches for a light total loadout of about 12 kilos. They traveled about the city in teams of 5, 1 non-com and 4 privates per team, and 12 teams to each duty section. Each man carried a SIG assault rifle, 2 of which had grenade launchers slung underneath the barrel. The sergeant also carried a pistol, and 2 men in each team carried radios. The teams on patrol were in constant radio contact and regularly practiced mutual support maneuvers. Half of each duty section walked, while the other half moved about slowly and menacingly in American-built HMMWVs. Essentially an oversized jeep, each Hummer had at least a pintle-mounted machine gun, and some had 6-barreled miniguns plus Kevlar armor to protect the crews against the casual enemy. At the commanding note of their horns, everyone cleared a path. At the command post were several armored fighting vehicles, English-built armored cars that could just barely navigate the streets of the ancient city. Always on duty at the post was a platoon-sized unit commanded by a captain. This was the emergency response team. They were armed with heavy weapons, like the Swedish Carl Gustav M2 recoilless, just the right thing for knocking a hole in any building. Supporting them was an engineer section with copious quantities of high explosives. The sappers ostentatiously practiced by knocking down those settlements which Israel had agreed to abandon. In fact, the entire regiment practiced its combat skills at those sites, and people were allowed to observe from a few hundred meters away in what was rapidly becoming a genuine tourist attraction. Already, Arab merchants were producing t-shirts with logos like Robo-Soldier for anyone who cared to buy them. The commercial sense of the merchants was not unrewarded. The Swiss guards did not smile, nor did they speak to the casual interrogator, a facility that came easily to them. Journalists were encouraged to meet with the commanding officer, Colonel Jacques Schwindler, and were occasionally allowed to speak with lower ranks in barracks or at training exercises, but never on the street. Some contact with the locals was inevitable, of course. The soldiers were learning rudimentary Arabic, and English sufficed for everyone else. They occasionally issued traffic citations, though this was mainly a function of the local civil police force that was still forming up, with support from the Israelis who were phasing out of the function. More rarely, a Swiss guard would step into a street fight or other disturbance. Most often, the mere sight of a 5-man team would reduce people to respectful silence and docile civility. The mission of the Swiss was intimidation, and it didn't require many days for people to appreciate how good they were at it. At the same time, their operations depended most of all on something other than the physical. On the right shoulder of each uniform was a patch. It was in the shape of a shield. The centerpiece was the white cross on red background of the Swiss to demonstrate the origin of the soldiers. Around it were the Star and Crescent of Islam, the 6-pointed Judaic Star of David, and the Christian cross. There were three versions of the patch, so that each religious emblem had an equal chance of being on top. It was publicly known that the patches were distributed at random, and the symbology indicated that the Swiss flag protected them all equally. The soldiers deferred always to religious leaders. Colonel Schwindler met daily with the religious troika which governed the city. It was believed that they alone made policy, but Schwindler was a clever, thoughtful man whose suggestions from the first had carried great weight with the imam, the rabbi, and the patriarch. Schwindler had also traveled to the capitals of every Middle East nation. The Swiss had chosen well. He'd been known as the best colonel in their army. An honest and scrupulously fair man, he'd acquired an enviable reputation. Already on his office wall was a gold-mounted sword, a present from the king of Saudi Arabia. A stallion of equal magnificence was quartered at the guard force encampment. Schwindler didn't know how to ride. It was up to the troika to run the city. They had proven to be even more effective than anyone had dared to hope. Chosen for their piety and scholarship, each soon impressed the others. It had been agreed upon at once that each week there would be a public prayer service particular to one of the represented religions, and that each would attend, not actually participating, but demonstrating the respect that was at the foundation of their collective purpose. Originally suggested by the imam, it had unexpectedly proven to be the most effective method of tempering their internal disagreements and also setting the example for the citizens of the city in their care. This was not to say that there were not disagreements, but those were invariably difficulties between two of the members, and in such cases the uninvolved third would mediate. It was in the interests of all to reach a peaceful and reasonable settlement. The Lord God, a phrase each of the three could use without prejudice, required their goodwill, and after a few initial teething problems, that goodwill prevailed. Over coffee, after concluding one dispute over scheduling access to one shrine or another, the Greek patriarch noted with a chuckle that perhaps this was the first miracle he had ever witnessed. No, the rabbi had replied, it was no miracle that men of God should have the conviction to obey their own religious principles. All at once? The imam had asked with a smile. Perhaps not a miracle, but certainly it had required over a millennium to achieve. Let us not begin a new dispute, the Greek had said with a rumbling laugh, over the settlement of another. Now if you can only help me find a way to deal with my fellow Christians. Outside on the streets, when clerics of one faith encountered those of another, greetings were exchanged to set an example for everyone. The Swiss guards saluted each in their turn, and when speaking with the most senior, they would remove their glasses or helmets to show public respect. That was the only humanity the Swiss guards were allowed to demonstrate. It was said that they didn't even sweat. Scary sons of bitches, Ryan observed, standing in shirt sleeves at a corner. American tourists snapped pictures. Jews still looked a touch resentful. Arabs smiled. The Christians who'd largely been driven out of Jerusalem by increasing violence had barely started to return. Everyone got the hell out of their way as the five men moved briskly down the street, not quite marching, their helmeted heads turning left and right. They really do look like robots. You know, Avi said, there hasn't been a single attack on them since the first week. Not one. I wouldn't want to fool with them, Clark observed quietly. In the first week, as though by providence, an Arab youth had killed an elderly Israeli woman with a knife. It had been a street robbery rather than a crime with political significance, and had made the mistake of doing so in view of a Swiss private who'd run him down and subdued him with a martial arts blow right out of a movie. The Arab in question had been taken to the troika and given the choice of a trial by Israeli or Islamic law. He'd made the mistake of choosing the latter. After a week in an Israeli hospital to allow his injuries to heal, he'd faced a trial in accordance with the word of the Quran, chaired by Imam Ahmed bin Yusuf. One day after that, he had been flown to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, driven to a public square, and after having had time to repent his misdeeds, publicly beheaded with a sword. Ryan wondered how you said pour encourager les autres in Hebrew, Greek, and Arabic. Israelis had been amazed at the speed and severity of justice, but the Muslims had merely shrugged and pointed out that the Quran had its own stern